I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times.
We've talked long enough about putting New Jersey on a responsible path to $15 an hour minimum wage. Today, we start our way on this path.
That was New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy last week signing a bill that will boost the minimum wage in the state from $8.85 to $15 an hour for most workers phased in over the course of the next 5 years. And that makes New Jersey the fourth state to take steps to dramatically increase wages for low-wage workers. Over here in Pennsylvania, Governor Wolf has called for similar legislation. We asked Catherine Lannergan to join us, and she covers labor, taxes, and politics for Politico New Jersey. Catherine Lannergan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, you can join our conversation. We've got three big topics to talk about in this hour of Radio Times. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Catherine, how much of a legislative victory was this for the governor starting his second year?
This is a major victory. I mean, this is something that the governor had campaigned on and that both the Senate and Assembly had wanted to get done. And so the fact that they were able to finally do it was a big victory.
Well, take us through the negotiations over the past year. And we should say that the Democrats controlling the legislature, and they also, of course, have a Democratic governor. What were some of the back and forth to get to this point?
Yeah, so I think what they had going for them was both the legislature and the governor, they all wanted to get to 15 over a period of years. But part of the problem was they disagreed on a lot of the policy differences. So Senate President Steve Sweeney, for example, he wanted some carve-outs for farm workers, for teenagers, and the governor wanted a clean 15, so a minimum wage bill that went to $15 an hour for everyone.
And how did it all end up? Who won that battle?
I would say that it kind of skewed more towards the governor's side of things. Assembly Speaker Craig Coughlin is really credited, I believe, with kind of forging a compromise between the two men. But at the end of the day, you know, there were some exemptions for businesses, but it really did favor more left-leaning Democrats.
Where did the Republicans stand on raising the minimum wage in New Jersey?
They're opposed to it. I mean, many Republicans were for some kind of increase in the minimum wage, but not to go all the way up to 15. There was a package of bills to increase it to $13 an hour, but that never went anywhere.
And how about business interests or groups representing businesses in New Jersey? What was their stance on this?
So they agreed that the raises should that wages should increase, but they really wanted a lot of different exemptions for businesses. And I think at the end of the day, you know, they got some of those things, but it really did not go certainly as far as they would have liked.
And how about the public? What has been the public's stance on the minimum wage in New Jersey?
So this is an interesting question. So there hasn't been a lot of polling on this subject in New Jersey. There was one poll in October, I believe, by Fairleigh Dickinson University. And that poll found that residents did want to see an increase in the minimum wage, but not quite up to $15 an hour. But that said, that poll did not indicate that this increase would be over a period of years.
Oh, that's interesting. But how much did Governor Murphy, when he was campaigning for governor, how much did he make this a central part of his message?
I would say it was pretty key. I mean, it was certainly mentioned at most rallies that I went to, most speeches. It was definitely a key component of his platform.
So as it stands today, and this is going to change, minimum wage in New Jersey is $8.85 an hour. Take us through, I guess, the timetable, how that will increase over, the next 5 years?
Yeah, let me pull it up right here. It's a little complicated.
Okay. Well, I'll pull it up with you. No, go ahead, Catherine.
So we'll go up to $10 an hour on July 1 of this year. Then it goes up again to $11 an hour on January 1st. And then it will increase by a dollar every January until 2024.
And that would get it. Go ahead.
Oh, it's okay. And then that would get it to 15. But this is one piece that hasn't really been reported on quite as much. So in New Jersey, the minimum wage has to be adjusted every year to account for inflation. So theoretically, it will continue to go up even more.
So even after 2024, if it's connected or tied to inflation, if inflation goes up, then the minimum wage would go up with it.
Correct.
Now, help us understand who you talked about some of these carve outs. As it stands mm-hmm. today, then who would this apply to?
Sure. So it's not like a strict carve out. I guess it's more of a slower phase in. So for farm workers, seasonal workers, and employees at small businesses, it's going to take a longer amount of time. So, for example, for seasonal workers and employees at businesses, five workers or less, it will get them until they'll get to 15 by 2026 instead of 2024.
So another 2 years on top of that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then farm workers will see their wages increase to $12.50 by 2024. And then at that point, there's a process that will likely get them up to 15 by 2027.
And how about for tipped workers? How does that work out?
Yeah, so this is a pretty big difference. I mean, it's not as big as some activists would have liked, but so right now, restaurants must pay out the federal minimum of $2.13 an hour. So the way that it works, if you're not familiar, is restaurants have to pay this base wage of $2.13, and then when tips are included, if they don't go up to the minimum wage, the employer has to pay out that difference. So the federal minimum, or so the New Jersey minimum, will go from $2.13 to $5.13 an hour. So that should give workers not a lot more money right. in their pockets, but a significant amount more.
Because I'm assuming for most tipped workers, they probably make more than $8.85 an hour.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, this is really only applying to, from what I've been told, is, you know, maybe if you have a really bad night when, you know, it's snowy, or, you know, you're at a diner where maybe people are just getting some coffee and something cheap to eat, it's possible. But yeah, it doesn't seem to be the norm.
I was reading about some local governments, and I'm assuming in New Jersey, if we're talking about union employees, can we assume that most of them are probably making 15 an hour or more?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, so there wasn't a lot of good information on this piece, but what's really interesting to just reiterate is that, so right now, if you work at a local government, they're not required by law to pay you the minimum wage, the state minimum wage. They just have to pay the federal, which is pretty an interesting piece that I wasn't aware of until I started reporting on this. But yeah, under this legislation, they'll have to go up to the full 15. But like you said, I mean, there's not a lot of people who are making less than 15. Mm-hmm. So while this will have some impact on their budgets, it's pretty unlikely that it's going to have a massive impact. I mean, some folks were predicting that this could maybe cause user fees to increase, things like that. But in terms of seeing any sort of property tax increase, it's highly, highly, highly unlikely.
So I'm thinking about some local governments where they're responsible to some degree for things like funding public schools or state governments or, mm-hmm. You know, some of these more locally based services. Your impression is that this won't have a serious impact on them?
No. I mean, it definitely, you know, it could have an impact. Maybe, you know, some layoffs. I think substitute teachers were kind of named as one of the as a category there of workers that could be impacted. Workers in libraries, teenage workers, kind of in the summer. But for the most part, it's really not going to have a huge impact. It's just kind of another thing that they're going to have to grapple with.
You mentioned teenagers. Does this apply to teenagers as well?
No, so it originally was going to, but they ultimately decided to not include, or not to exempt, rather, teenagers from the bill. So yes, teenagers will be paid the minimum wage on that schedule that most people are on. So this was a big victory for. There was a big group of teens at Make the Road New Jersey who lobbied pretty aggressively on this legislation. You know, they didn't have any lobbyists; they just went out and kind of did it themselves. It seems as though that really won over Assembly Speaker Craig Coughlin, in kind of getting getting this done.
So you're talking about young people coming to Trenton and making their case?
Yeah, coming to Trenton, meeting with lawmakers. They had petitions where they had thousands of signatures. It became a pretty big issue.
So how many people do you think then, since this now is the law and it passed in New Jersey, how many people do you think this will actually apply to?
It's estimated to be as many as 1 million workers in New Jersey. Now, what we need to realize is it's not that 1 million people are now making $8.85 an hour, but 1 million in between that $8.85 up to $15. Does that make sense?
It's sort of. Actually, expand on that just a bit further, if you could.
So basically, there are a lot of people making, $9 an hour, $10 an hour. They'll also see the increase, right?
Gotcha.
Even if they're not making the minimum wage right now. And so that's estimated to be about, I believe it's about 1 million workers, and that was according to New Jersey Policy Perspective, which is a left-leaning think tank in New Jersey.
You wrote in covering this about the quote-unquote fraught relationship between Governor Murphy and Senate President Steve Sweeney. Help us understand what this relationship is about and why it's so fraught.
Yeah. I think you could probably have an entire segment.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Maybe we'll come back for it. You're right.
About why. But, basically, Steve Sweeney and Phil Murphy don't get along. And Murphy has made some political missteps. That's how Sweeney has seen it. And they also have pretty big policy differences as well. Sweeney's a fiscal conservative. Murphy is very far left to most of the legislature. And so there was just a lot of tension. There's always a lot of tension between the two men, personality-wise and policy-wise. And that definitely was on full display in the minimum wage fight.
And you also wrote that Assembly Speaker Craig Coughlin, played, mediator here?
Yeah, this is kind of becoming a theme in Trenton, where you have Murphy on one side, Sweeney on the other, and Craig Coughlin's kind of in the middle, kind of mediating it. And that's what happened this time, too, it seems. He ended up finally, they were at an impasse for a really long time. There was a lot of time in Trenton where this bill wasn't being worked on, and lobbyists who I'd be speaking with would say, I can't believe that nothing's happened yet. This has been, they all want to get to 15 over a couple of years, and now it's a year later and we haven't gotten anywhere. But he really introduced the bill in December, and he's being credited with bringing both of them together.
Well, on that note, Catherine Landergan, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times and helping us understand what happened in New Jersey last week.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And she covers labor, taxes, and politics for Politico New Jersey. And we have a second guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about voting in Pennsylvania. In fact, efforts to update and improve the voting system in the Commonwealth. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY, continuing our regional roundup. The Blue Ribbon Commission on Pennsylvania's Election Security has recommended that the paperless direct recording electronic voting systems be replaced. That's quite a mouthful. The co-chairs of the committee wrote in an op-ed, without a voter-marked paper ballot, counties using these paperless systems cannot support meaningful recounts and post-election audits to instill confidence in the vote count. According to Voting Verified, 83% of Pennsylvania voters used paperless machines in last November's election. Governor Tom Wolf has called on the counties to buy new voting machines by 2020, something that will cost tens of millions of dollars. We asked Douglas Hill to join us. He is Executive Director of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania. Douglas Hill, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it's a great pleasure to be with you.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times anytime during the segment to join our conversation. So, Douglas Hill, is it time to get rid of the DRE, the Direct Recording Electronic Voting System?
Well, our counties had in place a priority to begin putting in new systems for a while now. The systems we have statewide all date back to about 2006, and we're approaching the end of their useful life. But we would still dispute whether they have any particular vulnerabilities. They're still good for the purpose, but we've recognized that there's an increased public demand for security. There are better technologies available, and so we are proceeding with the replacement. Our concern, though, that replacement was accelerated considerably by the settlement agreement that Governor Wolf entered with the Jill Stein campaign. And so while we're proceeding with the replacement, it is on a quicker schedule than we might have hoped for.
Let me pick up on a couple of things. As you said, you do believe there are better technologies. Describe for us what you think would be a better voting system than the one that we currently have in most places in Pennsylvania.
Well, the directive and the settlement agreement require us to have systems in place that support paper audits. Right. And so that is, there's a piece of paper that has the vote recorded on it and can be visually inspected to do a recount should that become necessary. And that's the fundamental difference between the systems that we have now in most of the counties, which are called direct recording electronic. So it is an electronic vote similar to the electronic processes that you do in most of your purchases today, but they don't have a paper audit function.
Right. How much, looking at these new machines that do have a paper readout, how much did they cost and what would it cost Pennsylvania to replace them all?
Mm-hmm. The cost per machine varies based on the technology. So there are some that are simply what's called optical scans. So mm-hmm. the voter by hand fills in the ballot and then they're run through a scanner. Then there are others where it is a touch screen or something similar that prints out a ballot that's machine marked. And then that's also scanned for counting purposes. So the upfront cost by machine varies. But dependent on the selections counties ultimately make, the statewide estimate is about $125 million altogether to do the replacements.
And who? This, of course, is a sore subject. Who picks up the cost there?
Well, under current law, it's entirely borne by the county. But Governor Wolf made a commitment when the settlement was reached that he would seek to have at least half of that cost paid by the General Assembly. He did include some funding in his request that he submitted to them earlier this week. He spread it out over 5 years, and it amounts to about half of that overall cost. There's also some federal money available that is left over from the last set of equipment purchases back around 2006. That's about $14 million. But the governor, at the same time, has said his request is at least half of the cost to come from the state level. And he's willing to go higher if the General Assembly agrees to fund a higher number. Counties additionally are looking to move the schedule up. So the governor's proposed reimbursing us over a 5-year span. Counties, though, have to make that purchase up front this year. We can spread it out over 5 years, but then that adds a carrying cost. So it's more cost effective to the taxpayer if we buy them this year. And so we would like to accelerate the state payment schedule as well compared to what the governor proposed.
So spread out over the various counties in Pennsylvania, what are we talking about, $50 million, something like that?
Well, the total cost will be about $125 million.
Right.
The governor's proposal over 5 years is about $75 million.
Right. So you'd have to figure out how to make up the difference there. Does that mean raising taxes or can the commissioners, can you carry debt, for instance?
Well, we can carry debt, but ultimately the payment comes from the same source. So either we pay up front out of the local property tax or the debt service is paid out of the property tax. So the bottom line is anything that's not reimbursed by state and federal funds is going to come out of a local property tax dollar.
I was reading somewhere that if every person, I'm not sure if it's everyone that lives in Pennsylvania or every voting person paid an additional $10, that mm-hmm. would cover the cost of this. Do I have my math right there, Douglas Hill?
That's about the cost, yes. Right.
So about $10 per person.
Right.
Is that onerous?
Compared to the breadth of services that county government, state government provide, $125 million is a sizable number, but not compared to the billions that it costs us to provide all other services. But for the counties, part of the question is when the cost is being incurred. And had we incurred it on our own timeline, as our equipment actually approached the end of its useful life, that cost might have been spread out county by county over the next 3 to 5 years. Instead, it's all being front-loaded into 2019, and so all of the counties are making their replacements this year to meet the requirements of the settlement. And that does create both an upfront cost, but it also creates cash flow issues for all of the counties.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Douglas Hill, and he is the executive director of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania. And we're talking about both the governor of Pennsylvania that has called for new voting machines to be in place by 2020. That, of course, is next year. And also a blue ribbon panel that has called for new voting machines with paper readouts. And we're talking about the impact that this will have on counties in Pennsylvania and, of course, on you as well. So we want to know where you stand on replacing these voting machines, and if a paper readout is important to you or not. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm thinking about people that work the polls with these new systems, and of course we're talking about some complicated voting machines, I'm assuming. Do they have the kind of training that is needed in order to be able to really do their jobs at the polls?
Well, first, the equipment is not complicated. The point of any election equipment is to make voting as simple, safe, secure, and accurate as possible. And so as counties are making their selections, they're looking toward equipment that is intuitive, is easily understandable, and can easily be put in place. But that said, anytime you make a change, you have training that needs to be done. In this case, we have to train our own staff, we have to train the poll workers, and then ultimately we have to train the voters. What's made this interesting is that the settlement agreement says all of the new equipment has to be in place by April 2020,
right.
And that's a presidential primary. And so the concern with many of the counties is we don't want to do rollout in our largest turnout, highest visibility election. And so many of the counties are actually accelerating the schedule even further to try to have the equipment in place by this November, which is a municipal election. Granted, every election is just as important as the next one, but this is one that doesn't have national attention and doesn't have quite the turnout. And so we can learn a lot in training and implementation in this election so that we're absolutely ready for April of 2020.
You mentioned the litigation involving Jill Stein and her campaign in Pennsylvania. I'm curious about how her litigation has affected what county commissioners are going to be doing in Pennsylvania.
Sure. Well, it actually is the fundamental reason that we're headed in this direction. Governor Wolf's administration entered a settlement agreement with the Stein campaign. Her primary litigation, well, first, she had disputed some of the results of the vote counts in a couple of the counties in Pennsylvania. She didn't like our appeals process, and her case ultimately failed at the state level. And so instead, she brought litigation at the federal level to say that our voting equipment and our processes denied voters the capacity to know if their votes had been accurately cast. And so all that taken together, the Wolf administration made a determination that it made more sense to reach an out-of-court settlement than to proceed down the path of litigation that really could have been even more problematic for us.
Money aside, though, I mean, if you and everyone else and the county commissioners in Pennsylvania, if you were just awash with cash and could spend it as you see fit, does it make sense to invest in new voting machines?
We would have been investing in new machines anyhow, yes. The equipment that we had in place largely was in response to the Florida debacle back in 2000. And so all of the Pennsylvania counties replaced their equipment around 2006. Most judged that it was approaching the end of its useful life anyhow. So we would have been replacing over the next 2 to 8 years.
But not this year.
Not quite on this accelerated schedule, yes.
I hear you. Let me get Jen from South Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Jen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, yes. My name is Jen DeVore. I'm a block captain, a committee person. I've worked my polls on Election Day. Full disclosure, I'm also a candidate for Philadelphia City Commissioner. My question is, what is the process of public input and transparency, not just in Philadelphia, but really across the state? As somebody that uses the machines, both as a voter and someone that has worked the polls, I think we should all have a say in this major purchasing decision.
And what do you mean by say, Jen? I'm curious.
An opportunity to demo the machines or to learn more about how the paper ballots are actually accounted for, to see not just what machines to be purchased or systems to be in place, but, you know, we need to take things like storage into consideration and the amount of people needed to manage the systems that we have. So other than I know there's been some public hearings with the commissioners here locally, but I think that there needs to be more of an opportunity for people that will use the machines to provide their input.
Fair enough. Jen, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Douglas Hill, go ahead.
Sure. Yes, we've actually been doing quite a bit to give the public access to the types of equipment that's available in the decision-making process. So, as she indicated, City of Philadelphia has held its own local hearing and done some demonstrations. Most of our counties have invited all the vendors in, have set up showcases, and invited the general public as well as poll workers and others in to take a look at the equipment and to give feedback on what equipment they like. The Department of State itself, Pennsylvania's Department of State, has overall responsibility for election management in the Commonwealth, and they themselves have also sponsored a number of showcases in different areas of the state. There's probably been at least 6 or 8 of those so far, and I think more are scheduled.
Jen, I appreciate the call. Here's an email from Stu who says, in computers, convenience comes with reduced security always. The only downside to paper ballots is slower knowledge of results. Based on this, the paper ballots going forward, do you imagine that slowing down results, Douglas Hill?
No, it won't slow down the results because in every one of the paper technologies, the initial count is done as a scan. So it's run through a scanner. The scanner does the tally. But the purpose of it being on paper is to have an audit trail. So if there's a dispute about the election or the results, then as a last resort, the paper can be relied upon to do a hand count if necessary. But up front, the results are still can still be rendered as quickly.
Let me ask you, I don't know whether this is in your bailiwick or not, but do you think it's too hard to vote in Pennsylvania? And I say that knowing that early voting is really difficult to do. If you're not a Republican or a Democrat, you don't get to vote in a primary. There are other feel like restrictions in the Commonwealth. And I'm curious whether the County Commissioners Association has a stand on any of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, you raise a good point because voting isn't just about the system that we vote on. It's about registration. It's about access to the polls. It's about knowledge of the candidates and the ballot questions and so on. And we do as much as we can to encourage voting. That said, There are a couple calendar issues in Pennsylvania that folks have said should be compressed. The amount of the deadline for registration to vote, for example, the deadline for requesting absentees, the deadline for submitting absentee ballots are things that we know the legislature is going to be looking at to try to make more accessible to the voting public and to help expedite their capacity to place a ballot.
Well, and we know Pennsylvania is a battleground state, not just in 2016, but in previous elections as well.
Well, and certainly for the presidential, but you take a look at most of our races. Most of our races are highly competitive. We saw relatively significant turnover in the Pennsylvania General Assembly this year. We saw turnover at the congressional level. And folks really need to pay attention to their local races, too, because that's where many important decisions are being made that affect taxes and affect services. And so turnout at the polls is not just a right, but something that's very important for people to take advantage of.
We have to say goodbye to you, but let me read a comment from Elizabeth, who says, I'm a former judge of elections in Pennsylvania, and I'm not concerned about the changing system slowing things down because poll workers have to go through training all the time anyway, which underscores, Douglas Hill, what you were saying earlier. So to voters in Pennsylvania that sometimes feel nervous that their vote did not count, you can say to us, it does. It will?
It absolutely does. And rest assured, administration of the voting system is something that every county commissioner takes seriously. It's one of our highest responsibilities to the democratic process.
Well, on that note, Douglas Hill, thanks for joining us at AM Radio Times.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. And he is the executive director of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. It's our regional roundup, as we are calling it. And we'll be talking about a bill making its way through city council here in Philadelphia, banning cashless businesses. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoena, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia as we continue our regional roundup. Using digital banking products and mobile payments are an increasingly popular way of doing business, offering convenience at both ends of the transaction. The problem is there are millions of U.S. households that are underbanked, paying cash for the products and services they buy instead of using things like credit cards or debit cards. Here in Philadelphia, almost 6% of the population is unbanked, and about 20% are considered underbanked. That's according to the FDIC and our guest, Christian Hetrick. He's consumer reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And he wrote last week about a bill in Philadelphia City Council that would prevent retailers from going cashless, hitting them up with fines if they did. There's a similar bill, interestingly, in New Jersey. Christian Hetrick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join this conversation. Help us understand this bill. And I guess the author of it is Councilman William Greenlee.
Yeah, that's correct, as well as Councilwoman Maria Quiñones Sanchez, both Democrats. And the bill, as you described, it would prohibit retailers from refusing to accept cash, would also prevent them from charging more for cash-paying customers. And with some exemptions, it would apply to all brick-and-mortar retailers, and violators could get fined $2,000.
Oh, wow. For each transaction?
The way it would work is if you're a consumer and you got turned away because you didn't have cash, you could file a complaint with the city, and they would investigate and then could then impose the fine.
Where did this bill come from? I mean, what were the authors responding to?
Sure. So Councilman Greenlee had heard about some of the retailers in Philadelphia that are cashless. There's not many. Right. Sweetgreen is kind of the popular one, the salad chain, as well as Bluestone Lane, a coffee shop, and at UPenn, the food hall they have. There's some cashless locations as well. And he thought that was discriminatory against the population you described, the unbanked, who, because they don't have checking accounts or access to credit, they pay in cash. And so he thought that was discriminating against that poorer population, disproportionately Black and Hispanic. And so he introduced this bill in advance from committee on last week.
But you're describing really a handful of businesses. So it's what, a kind of a preemptive bill in case others? And it does feel as if we are, as a country, even as a world, going cashless.
Yes, you're correct. Currently, there's not that many cashless businesses. And in fact, in New Jersey, lawmakers are kind of struggled to identify any that were currently doing it. But you're right, the trend is going that way. There was a Pew study, 29% of people don't use cash, and that's up from 24% in 2015. And likewise, you have a population who only use cash. It's about 18%, and that's down from 24%. So you can kind of see the trend towards more people using plastic and mobile devices and things of that nature.
When you wrote that 6% of Philadelphians are unbanked, let's talk about the unbanked, and then we'll talk about the underbanked.
Sure.
But to be unbanked in the city, how do people, for instance, pay their bills?
So there's check cashers. You can go in or pawn shops where you can take your paycheck and get it cash. There's a fee, sometimes as high as 10% if it's a personal check. And that's how you get cash. Right. And then you can load it onto a prepaid card, but there's a fee that goes along with that as well. But that's primarily how people pay their bills, is they go to these check cashers or these alternative financial services.
And obviously, I mean, are we talking about low-wage workers that maybe just can't afford a bank account, or just this is just the way they do business?
Right. So, they don't get bank accounts because of the overdraft fees, perhaps. If they go below zero, they get hit with a fine, or a fee, I should say. And there's also like monthly fees that go along with just having a checking account. There's some free checking accounts, but not all.
But you generally have to keep your...
There's minimum balance requirements, right. So those are some of the barriers that prevent people from, you know, getting a bank account.
How about under...
Underbanked.
Yeah,
another 22%. And these are people who, they technically have bank accounts, but they're still relying on those alternative financial services like check cashers, as we described. So they still have bank accounts. That's why they're not unbanked, but still largely not using the mainstream financial system.
I mean, that's a quarter of the population, right? When you add those two together.
Exactly, yeah.
Interestingly, if you use... what's the word I'm looking for? I guess pawn shops or others.
Yes.
You do get charged, and if you're late, you get even charged even more.
Yeah.
So it's an expensive way to get money.
It's the high cost of being poor in some cases, yeah. So, I think when I did a story on this separately, I think I saw up to 10% for a personal check, and then lower, you know, 4, 5, 6% for an employee check. But still, you know, that's before you get to even spend it, so...
Are there efforts in city council to try to figure out how to get people bank accounts so that they can have things like a credit card or a debit card or a way of having these less expensive ways of doing transactions?
Yeah. So the city does have an Office of Financial Empowerment. They have a coalition. I think it's called Bank On. And it's trying to get people into low-cost bank accounts, the free checking accounts, ones that don't have overdraft fees or minimum balance requirements. So there is that effort. But obviously, as the statistics showed, there's still a large population who just don't have bank accounts.
So where do you think, where's this bill going next?
So the full city council can vote on it as early as Thursday. Doesn't necessarily mean they will, but the bill would be eligible to be voted on as soon as Thursday. And it advanced from committee last week, 4-1. Not much opposition. There was the one Republican, David O, who, you know, spoke about the business concerns of having a government mandate, and the Commerce Department and within the city, you know, said that they support a pause on this, but noted that this could make Philly less competitive. There are companies like Amazon who are doing these cashless stores, and, you know, in theory, if Philly has this ban, maybe they don't open one in Philadelphia because of that.
Interesting. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Christian Hetrick, and he's consumer reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And we asked him to join us to talk about a bill that is making its way through city council here in Philadelphia that would essentially fine businesses if they went cashless. And about 6% of the population unbanked, and about 20% are so-called underbanked. We want to hear from you, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Vinti wrote a comment, I studied abroad in Sweden, and they have a very widespread cashless system. This is because they have a very transparent banking system, and I think this is something we should try to adopt. I know nothing about the Swedish system. I don't know if you do, Christian, or not.
I just read a few articles on it, but certainly no expert on it. But India is also going towards cashless, and a few cities in China are going cashless as well. So again, kind of like the inevitability maybe that we discussed, that as more consumers go cashless, cities, states, et cetera, could do so as well.
Right. Or coming up with a system that doesn't hurt people that that can't use a credit or debit card.
Right.
Are retailers interested in this because is it easier to use a credit card or a mobile device?
Yeah, there's kind of a few reasons. There's security concerns, lowers the risk of robbery if it's well known that you don't have cash in the register. The lines can go quicker if you don't have to count out change. Right? You can just swipe the phone and there you go. Those are kind of like the two primary.
That's okay. Notes here myself.
Yeah, no. And, they would also tax compliant. That's actually another one, too. They would argue that they're more likely to be tax compliant. There's no, cash under the table because there's literally no cash, in the store itself. So those are kind of the main, top points as far as why they would say going cashless is good.
Were there people testifying before this committee about going cashless? Or
most people were in support of the ban. But even those who were in support of it just want it really temporarily because they do acknowledge that this is the direction that it's going in. But there are the Pennsylvania Restaurant and Lodging Association. I know they're against this bill. They didn't testify, but, they outlined some of the concerns that I just mentioned. They think, consumers should vote with their wallets. There are cash only businesses that you may not patronize because you think they should, take credit card. So they would argue that, you should let consumers make the decision ultimately and let businesses operate however they want.
It's interesting to think of this as a kind of a temporary fix until we sort of figure out how to get people the ability to figure out how to bank everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly it. There's a sense of inevitability that this is where the technology is going. But until then, maybe push the pause button and let some of the poorer people catch up.
Here's a question from Dale. Are there legal implications for not honoring, quote, legal tender?
It's actually a good question.
Is it? I'm not exactly sure what Dale's getting at, but no, go ahead.
No, yeah. So when you look at your dollar bill, there is, this is legal tender for all debts. I don't know what it exactly is. And I looked into that as well because it's a common, isn't this legal tender? But the Federal Reserve actually says that there's no federal law requiring businesses to take cash. And so really businesses can have their own policies unless there's a state or local law that says otherwise.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So city council would say otherwise?
City council would say otherwise, but there's no federal law. There's no federal requirement that businesses have to take cash.
Interesting. Dale, thanks for the question there. And you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. One of the words that I read that's applied to retailers I'm doing double negatives here, which has never been my forte. But the idea of banning cashless places, that's a form of discrimination.
Banning the cashless stores is discrimination against the business?
Well, the idea that I guess really it's against the customer because of the I guess the higher fees that they might have to pay.
Oh, like a merchant fee on a credit card. Yeah. Sure. There are costs associated with for the business for handling cash, right? As well. That is an interesting point. True.
You mentioned New Jersey. Now, New Jersey did pass some legislation, right?
Yes, the full legislature passed it overwhelmingly, 39-0 in the Senate, 72-2 in the Assembly. It's on the governor's desk now. Very little opposition that I was aware of. More interestingly, too, is not even fewer actual cashless stores. Really, I can only identify one, an Amazon store in North Jersey.
In the whole state of New Jersey?
In the whole state of New Jersey. I understand there may be some kiosks in the airports as well. But as far as a brick-and-mortar retailer, There's one Amazon cashless bookstore, but they passed this thing, and you know it's on the governor's desk now.
Any sense of where Governor Murphy might stand?
I asked the governor's office, but they just said they're reviewing the legislation. Right. Didn't hint one way or another.
Interesting. I mean, it is interesting to think, as I mentioned earlier, the fact that so many of us, and including retailers, are going essentially mm-hmm. cashless, mm-hmm. Whether it would have some kind of a business impact.
Yeah. Going cashless, you know, for the businesses, you know, as I mentioned before, that there are costs associated with handling cash.
Right.
David O cited some studies that you know, you have an employee who has to work, you know, to balance the register at the end of a shift. You have to have a security truck maybe drop off cash, or you go to the bank yourself and get the cash. So there are, you know, costs with handling cash as well as the merchant fees with credit cards. And
sure.
So I guess some businesses decide, you know, what the trade-off is, which one they prefer.
Let me get, it looks like Steve from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I just wanted to add to that exact point that there are costs associated with handling cash. And one of them that seems to be increasing is banks now charging businesses to get rolls of change and also for depositing cash. They give you a limit as to how much cash you're allowed to deposit into your account each month. And when you exceed it, there are fees. So they're kind of squeezing us on the cash side as well. They don't want to handle cash. They don't want to do change. They don't want us coming in and dealing with their tellers to get change. Mm-hmm. They want us to either go to those Brinks trucks or to go to credit cards. So there definitely are pressures on businesses to think about going cashless as well. Just wanted to add that.
I'm glad you did, Steve. Just a quick question. You have a business in Philadelphia then?
Yes, I have two brick-and-mortar retail hardware stores.
And
Country Hardware and Third Street Hardware.
Okay. All right. And so
and we left one bank because they kept lowering the amount of cash that we were allowed to deposit into our account each month and increasing the fees, and went to another large bank, which had a higher limit, but we're still paying service charges for the simple fact that we're depositing cash.
So what do you think about this bill in Philadelphia?
Well, as we see more and more people going to credit, it would be nice to be able to have just one or the other and not to have to deal with both. I mean, I understand the side of it, the discrimination against people who don't have credit cards, but more and more and more of our business is going to credit for smaller and smaller amounts. You know, people coming in and buying a couple of screws, it's 27 cents, and they want to put it on the credit card. We say, you know, just steal it. It would be cheaper. The fees are coming at us in every direction.
I hear
so, you know, it'd be nice to not have to, you know, process all these different forms of payment and pay fees on all of it.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, getting that perspective. And I'm assuming you don't want people stealing screws and nuts and bolts from your
no,
stores.
I'm pointing out that, you know, the fees just keep going up and up and up, and the banks are the ones in charge of that. So.
I hear you. Let
whether it's cash or credit card.
Sure. Anything you want to add to that, Christian?
I would just be curious if he's interested in going cashless, or is he not on the air anymore?
Do we still have you, Steve?
No. So we are interested as we continue to see the amount of credit card, you know, go up and up and up every year and the amount of cash go down. It does seem like we're doing a lot of work, you know, processing lesser and lesser amounts of cash and paying more and more to do so. So we're definitely interested. We're not at the point where we would do it, but I am a customer at Sweetgreen's, and so I see that it has some advantages for them.
We're
definitely thinking about it, or would think about it for sure.
Go ahead, Christian.
Yeah, and just I think his concerns, you know, mimic those that have been brought up by the business community as well. And you know, particularly, you know, if this bill would make Philly less competitive in attracting businesses, if businesses like his are wanting to go cashless and they can't, you know, this bill may turn them away.
Well, Christian Hetrick, thank you for coming in and talking about this bill. It'll be very interesting to see where it goes.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he's a consumer reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. And if you want to download a podcast of Radio Times, you can go to iTunes or NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.